Over 50 years after Mario Savio led the free speech movement at the University of California, Berkeley, a movement that began with students fighting for the right to hand out anti-war literature on campus, the university has become the center of a new debate about the First Amendment. In Fighting Words, New Yorker contributing editor Andrew Marantz looks at how former Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos co-opted Mario Savio's legacy and became a poster child for a different kind of free speech movement. Fighting Words is published in the July 2nd issue of The New Yorker and appears online with the title How Social Media Trolls Turned UC Berkeley into a Free Speech Circus. I'm happy that it's brought Andrew back to our show. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you begin the piece in the Free Speech Movement Cafe on the UC Berkeley campus. What is Mario Savio's legacy among students and professors there today?
It is a huge outside legacy, but it's divided. You know, I mean, not to be too grandiose about it, but it kind of reminds me of, you know, the way Thomas Jefferson is used at the University of Virginia or, you know, Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia. You know, he's sort of this outsized figure who means many things to many people. And, free speech is a symbol that everybody can rally behind as long as it's kept in the abstract. But, you know, the trick is that when you put a fine point on it, people start disagreeing. So everybody thinks they love free speech and everybody does love free speech. But, you know, when it gets weaponized in different ways, that's where the clashes start.
Yeah, and it's an important point that a symbol ultimately can be used to mean whatever the person using it wants it to mean. You describe Milo Yiannopoulos as a right-wing professional irritant. Was this always his full-time job?
As far as I can tell, pretty much. I mean, the only part of that I could think of that would be at all controversial is the right-wing part, because a lot of people think he doesn't really have much of an intrinsic ideology as much as just a desire for attention. But he clearly saw an opening to use free speech as a cudgel, not only as a way to get attention, but as a way to try to get the moral high ground, right? So he's an immigrant from the UK. He came here, he says, because, you know, the United States has this lovely First Amendment that, you know, he claims to be, you know, an absolute devotee of. The problem, of course, is that, you know, when you claim to be a free speech absolutist, you're not actually doing a very nimble reading of the First Amendment. So Milo and people who tend to support him, you know, on Fox News and in other places, sometimes will say, oh, the First Amendment says that you can say whatever you want in any way you want to whomever you want. And that's not exactly what it says.
So from 2016-2017, Yiannopoulos visited dozens of colleges across the country as part of what he called his, and I'm quoting here, dangerous faggot tour. What did he talk about during his so-called lectures?
Well, you know, part of it was just having fun and, you know, trying to get people like us to, you know, repeat words like that on the radio.
Right.
Part of it was... you know, what he claimed was comedy. You know, he does this thing where, you know, when he wants to make a point, he says, you know, I'm a very serious political pundit. You know, I went to Cambridge for a couple of years and all that stuff. And then as soon as he's in hot water about something, he says, oh, no, I'm a comedian. I'm a performance artist. I was only kidding. So he went to all these various colleges doing all kinds of different stunts, you know, being carried in on a litter, you know, making fun of trans students, threatening undocumented students. He never actually did this, but there were rumors that he was going to name undocumented students from the stage, which might have triggered their deportation. So, you know, some of it was, you know, just words and not sticks and stones. But when you start harassing individuals, when you start targeting people based on their gender identity or when you start, you know, threatening people with deportation, that does get into sticks and stones territory.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Andrew Marantz about his article Fighting Words in the July 2nd issue of The New Yorker. You're right to underscore the performative element of his work. I mean, that really dominates your piece. And it almost seems as though sort of free speech is a vehicle for the performance as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, and look, I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution or in you know, the subsequent history of First Amendment jurisprudence that says you know, only serious or worthy people are protected by the First Amendment. You know, performance artists and comedians are protected by the First Amendment. I mean, so are, you know, just idiots and clowns. And I mean, everyone is protected by the First Amendment. The only issue is how far do those protections go? So they don't extend into harassment, right? They don't extend into threats. They don't extend into shouting fire falsely in a crowded theater. So there are limits. And, you know, when people, you know, express allegiance to the abstract notion of free speech, you know, that's all well and good, and everybody, including myself and you know, everyone can get behind that. But it did seem clear that Milo was using it as a convenient shield. And I should say, you know, I sort of hesitated to use him as a test case because I think, you know, a lot of people felt, and I was sympathetic to this feeling, that, you know, he had gotten enough attention already.
Right.
But, you know, the fact is, and I kind of allude to this in the piece, you know, the best test cases for the gray areas of free speech are not always, you know, the loftiest forms of human expression. You know, there were lots of people who went to speak at Berkeley and gave really nice, measured, dulcet lectures about, you know, Milton or whatever. Those don't present a test case because they weren't controversial.
Yeah, no, as you point out, sometimes it's something like a T-shirt that says bong hits for Jesus, right?
Yeah, that one got all the way to the Supreme Court.
Exactly. So UC Berkeley was the last stop on his tour. Why did he call for the administrators to be criminally prosecuted just 1 week prior to his arrival?
So this was about 2 weeks after Trump had been inaugurated. And, you know, there were a lot of places that were reaffirming their commitment to being sanctuaries from the draconian immigration policies that were to come from the Trump administration. And the city of Berkeley was one of those places, and the University of California was another one of those institutions. They both reaffirmed their commitment to protecting their undocumented students from the reach of the federal law. And so on Breitbart, Milo, you know, wrote this very kind of muddled, unclear piece where, again, it wasn't clear exactly what he was going to do, but there were rumors that he was going to try to get around these sanctuary policies by naming students from the stage. But, you know, the way First Amendment, I mean, it really is true what Milo says, that the United States has really unprecedentedly broad speech protections. And one of those protections is you can't stop someone from giving a speech because of what they might say. So he was allowed to go forward with it despite those rumors.
And the event led to massive protests on campus. Who was protesting?
There was a broad coalition of people who were protesting. Some of them were Berkeley students. Some of them were not. Some of them were just Berkeley locals, you know, as anyone who's been to that campus knows. And, you know, it's a particularly rich place to stage a symbolic pageant about free speech, not only because of the history of the free speech movement there, but also because it's this very big, you know, eminent public university. It's sort of intermingled with downtown Berkeley, which has its own reputation as a kind of left-wing haven. So, you know, in addition to the Berkeley students, there were a lot of local groups, some of whom identified as Antifa. And Antifa is willing to use violent tactics when they believe them to be necessary.
So how did Milo and his supporters use the presence of Antifa protesters to their advantage in the right-wing press?
Oh, it was great for them. I mean, it wasn't even only great for them in the right-wing press. It was kind of great for them across the board.
Right.
I mean, Antifa showed up, you know, the best estimates were that they were about 100 out of the 1,500 protesters. So it certainly wasn't the majority, but, you know, they showed up and started throwing rocks and throwing Molotov cocktails. They burned a bunch of lighting rigs. And, you know, again, since we're talking on the level of symbolism and semiotics, you know, they literally were a mob setting things on fire. It doesn't really, if, as many people proposed, and as I think sounds plausible, Milo's goal all along was to be censored so that he could then become a martyr of free speech censorship, this unruly violent mob did exactly that for him. So it worked out great for him. He was all over Fox News. His Facebook account got a lot of hits. The president tweeted about him. You know, I mean, as a day in the life of Milo, it doesn't really get much better than that. This is a guy who does not often have the moral or semiotic high ground. And on that day, he did.
So Carol Kreis, Berkeley's new chancellor, she invited Milo back to the campus. Why? What was her reasoning?
Free speech. You know, yeah. she believes, and I've had long conversations with her about this, that, you know, the kind of John Stuart Mill kind of classic liberal version of free speech is the best interpretation and the one she wants to follow. So she believes that all views should be allowed, basically that speech protection should be as broad as possible, again, with the exceptions of, you know, direct threats or, you know, incitement to immediate violence. You know, obviously she respects, you know, understands that there are limits, but she basically wants the protections to be as broad as possible. And she was pretty forthright with me in saying that, you know, I know that Berkeley is perceived as this liberal place. I know that, you know, the right wants to make us look hypocritical by, you know, making the claim that we protected these leftist students in the 60s, but we're not willing to protect conservatives. So she went way out of her way to try to make conservative speech events happen on the campus. Now, she's also aware, and many other people pointed this out to me, that the parallels are not very exact. You know, the people who led the free speech movement in the 60s were students who were struggling against their government. Milo is actually more aligned with the present federal administration than he is with Berkeley's right. students. So, you know, it's not an exact parallel, but she still was very, again, alert to the symbolism of it, and she really wanted Milo's second speech at Berkeley to go off without a hitch.
Has the Supreme Court been consistent in its interpretation of the First Amendment when it comes to freedom of speech?
It's, you know, nothing's ever perfectly consistent, but it's been fairly broad. I mean, it's been pretty consistently broad, at least for the past 50 or 60 years. So there was a time before the Warren Court where, you know, before Brandeis and all these justices kind of opened up the interpretation of the First Amendment, when there were doctrines like the Fighting Words Doctrine, which is where the piece gets its title from, where there were these big carve-outs to First Amendment protection. So the Fighting Words Doctrine was, if you say something that is just meant to incite someone, basically if you're just provoking someone into hitting you, then that speech, the value of whatever, you know, ideological content or intellectual content you're offering is outweighed by the provocativeness of it. And so the ruling then was, in 1940, this is not protected speech. Fighting words are not protected speech. So that, you know, the case that made that law was Chaplinsky, where, you know, a guy called a cop a damn fascist. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that was deemed to be provocative, that was deemed to be fighting words, and the guy was hauled off to jail for saying those words. That over time, the court kind of reversed course on that, and fighting words doctrine was chipped away, and many other sort of analogous doctrines that had been used to curtail speech were chipped away, and speech is now very, very free. It's actually become, you know, such a cornerstone of the Supreme Court that all kinds of people use it, you know, in Citizens United, free speech, you know, jurisprudence was used to protect political organizations, you know, corporations use it, tobacco companies use it to try to contend that they can't be compelled by the government to put Surgeon General's warnings on their packs of cigarettes. So it's become very, very broad, and basically the movement over time has been toward more libertarianism.
I'm speaking with New Yorker contributing editor Andrew Morantz about his latest article, Fighting Words. Later on in the show, we're taking calls from listeners with tips and stories for surviving this sweltering summer. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Andrew Morantz about his piece Fighting Words in the July 2nd issue of The New Yorker. Andrew, you spoke with John A. Powell, a Berkeley law professor who previously served as the national legal director of the ACLU. Tell me about his thoughts on the Voltairean tradition, the basic idea that I might not agree with you, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. What are his thoughts on that school of thought?
Yeah, I found his point of view fascinating. I mean, look, when you say someone is a former national legal director of the ACLU, you kind of expect to know where they're going to come down. You know, more right. speech protection is always better. And Professor Powell's view is it's really nuanced, but basically it sort of questions the view that the Voltaire / Mill point of view is the only point of view that we can bring to bear. And he basically says, you know, yeah, courts have gone in this direction, but that doesn't mean that the courts are necessarily correct, and that if we, you know, look to models that are more like Europe or more like Canada, where there are protections against hate speech, you know, maybe that wouldn't be the worst thing for the American system to pursue. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out this point isn't made explicitly in the piece, but the Supreme Court does not recognize hate speech as a separate category. You know, people throw around the term hate speech, and there's this kind of almost urban legend that hate speech is illegal in this country.
Right.
That's not really the case. There is no legal category called hate speech. And John Powell is saying maybe there should be.
Well, and one of the things that stood out to me about what he said is this idea that we could reframe the conversation, right, to be about free speech and equality as two conflicting values. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, he really brings us back to, I mean, he essentially reads the Constitution as being sort of two constitutions in one, you know, one pre-Civil War and one post-Civil War. So pre-Civil War, you have the Bill of Rights, which is obviously where we get the First Amendment. Post-Civil War, you have things like the 14th Amendment that provides for equal protection under the law and full citizenship under the law. And he basically says that in the same way that, you know, racial segregation was allowed under the First Constitution and the Second Constitution was brought into force in order to ban segregation, you know, that words could have a similar effect. You know, he sort of makes the argument that we now know a lot about stereotype threat. We now know a lot about PTSD. I mean, he basically said to me, look, you might think that all these college kids are just snowflakes and they're just walking around getting their feelings hurt. And, you know, every time they talk about speech being harmful to them, they're just being too delicate. But like, we actually know that words can cause measurable psychological harm. We know that if you yell at your child could develop an anxiety disorder. We know that if a girl texts her boyfriend and coaxes him into committing suicide, she can be held liable for I believe she was convicted of manslaughter, that young woman. So, you know, it's just not the case that words don't have effects in the world and that those effects can't be weighed by courts in various ways.
So using that kind of framework, how would it change the conversation about free speech at a place like UC Berkeley? Would it be about sort of trying to identify the injury that could be done?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I talked to lots of students who said, you know, kind of in that vein, you know, yeah, you know, we're caricatured as just being delicate little flowers. But, you know, when people make arguments that they perceive to be white supremacist arguments, that those arguments have consequences. And, you know, I mean, just the basic idea of stereotype threat is that, you know, if you activate the part of a person's brain that makes them feel inferior, there are measurable consequences. You know, they do worse on tests and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, again, that these things can be measured. This is the contention. And look, I mean, it's not without precedent in the world. You know, if we believe that the sort of basic underlying premise of a university is that ideas are important, ideas have value, ideas have consequences in the world, you know, there's no logical reason that ideas can't have consequences. Obviously, you want to weigh that against something else. So what the kind of Powell point of view would suggest is not that because something has harm, you know, you just run out and ban it. He's obviously, you know, again, having his background in the ACLU, he's not pro-banning anything. He's sort of making the case that these two things should be weighed in contention with each other. And I think one of the most powerful points he makes is that Brown v. Board, one of the most celebrated Supreme Court decisions in our history, is explicitly drawing on this legacy of psychological harm being a constitutionalizable concern.
Right. And it really stood out to me, too, in your reporting that our understanding of psychological harm has really developed in modern times in recent years. And that needs to be factored into this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in the same way that, you know, in sort of English common law, the best you could do was see if there were eyewitnesses to a crime. And that was kind of the only evidence you could bring to bear. They didn't have fingerprints. They didn't have DNA. They didn't actually know that eyewitness testimony was scientifically dubious at best. So, you know, to think that legal principles can't be updated as knowledge increases, I think just, you know, shouldn't be taken all that seriously.
You also refer to conservative pundit Ben Shapiro's campus lecture at Berkeley. How is he different from Milo Yiannopoulos?
He's different in about a million ways. Right. I mean, they dislike each other personally. They have a kind of personal rivalry going back many years. I mean, you know, this is Ben Shapiro is often referred to as alt-right or a white supremacist or a Nazi. In fact, Ben Shapiro is an Orthodox Jew who, you know, was the number one target of Twitter abuse from white supremacists during the run-up for the 2016 election. He was a never Trump guy. Now he's extremely conservative, and he has many views that the majority of Berkeley students detest. But the fact that he is sort of lumped in with the Nazis, despite the fact that he goes around wearing a yarmulke every day, I think makes it easy for him to kind of point out some of the hypocrisy of his critics. And it's an easy way for him to score points with his audience.
Well, and Ben Shapiro has declared that there's a campus free speech crisis in the U.S. What is he basing this on?
There is evidence for that, and there's evidence against that. So he's not the only one who makes this claim. I mean, you hear a lot of people making this claim, including a lot of progressives, who say, you know, every other day I hear some new story about a campus that is erupting in controversy over a speaker. This is crazy. Why won't these kids stop being so thin-skinned and just let people speak? And I think there's evidence for that proposition and evidence against it. You know, there was one Pew study that found that a large, I think 40% of college students do want offensive speech banned, which is out of step with the rest of the country. A Knight Foundation study the next year found that college students are way less likely than the rest of the country to want offensive speech banned. So the evidence is really mixed. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with the availability heuristic. You know, when you turn on the TV and see riots at a college campus, not only do you maybe not know the full context, but also, you know, how many other college campuses are inviting controversial speakers with no incident. That said, there are genuinely troubling things. You know, I allude to Brett Weinstein in my piece, who was, you know, for all intents and purposes, driven out of Evergreen State College for writing an email that some of his students didn't like. So, you know, it's not to say that there aren't any troubling incidents. The question is it a national crisis?
Political scientist Jeffrey Sachs told you, quote, "There is no campus free speech crisis. The kids are all right. Those that say otherwise have lost all perspective, and the real crisis may be elsewhere." What do you think he meant by that?
Yeah, that was in a tweet storm of his that sort of got widely picked up. I mean, he was basically parsing some of the data that I was referring to,
right,
in a kind of fine-grained way. I actually saw him debate Andrew Sullivan and Jonathan Haidt, who pushed back on that contention. And I think Jonathan Haidt, in a really nuanced way, sort of said, well, I take your point that this might not be a full-fledged crisis. I mean, if you were to watch Fox and Friends, which I have done a lot of, you would basically think that every college campus is on fire and, you know, Colin Kaepernick is the only person who can speak on a college campus and be welcomed. You know, obviously it's exaggerated. Obviously that's not true. But I think Jonathan Haidt, kind of pushing back on this thesis, basically said, well, you know, it's not that 99% of college students are hostile to free speech, but you know, there might have been a shift since the 60s. And I think the underlying point, whatever you think of the fine-tuned data sets, the underlying point that that the symbolic value of free speech has shifted since the 60s and become more of a cudgel on the right than on the left, I think that's definitely true.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Andrew Marantz about his piece Fighting Words in the July 2nd issue of The New Yorker. So on the day of Milo Yanni, I keep struggling with his last name, we'll call him Milo when he returns to Berkeley Free Speech Week, what were the campus administrators anticipating?
Everybody was on edge. Everybody was worried about violence, which was not hypothetical. There was violence just the last time he arrived. The question was how to handle it. You know, do you handle the violence by increasing the police presence, decreasing the police presence? Do you ignore it? Do you protest it more vigorously but nonviolently? And again, the reason I focus on this is because I think it's a good microcosm for the rest of the country. You know, when someone is is saying something or doing something you find appalling, how do you best respond to it? I don't think anybody has a satisfactory answer. So, yeah, they basically were trying to, they basically wanted the opposite spectacle. If the spectacle last time was people setting stuff on fire, the spectacle this time they wanted was, you know, a nice, calm, you know, speaker's corner, and then just a progression through the rest of the year without too much incident.
You met with Yiannopoulos when he was staying at a, quote, secret location in a nearby suburban strip mall hotel. Who was with him?
He was with Mike Cernovich and Pam Geller, who were two of the many headliners he had promised. It basically became clear after, you know, Milo made all these big promises about his event. You know, he's a big self-promoter. He was talking about how Free Speech Week was going to be this great party, and it was going to be an extravaganza, and he was going to have James Damore there and Charles Murray there and Heather McDonald. And, you know, he was basically bluffing about all of that. He said he was going to have Steve Bannon. None of that came to pass. It was just him, Mike Cernovich, Pam Geller, you know, two of his old friends and comrades kind of on the far right, and some kind of local hangers-on and employees just sitting around this kind of tacky hotel bar by themselves. It was kind of pathetic.
It's quite a scene, you know, and in your exchange with him, I couldn't help get the sense that all of this is sort of some kind of game for him, that it's essentially a show that he's playing with as some sort of villain-type character. I don't know, did you get a feeling along those lines?
Yeah, definitely. It all seemed pretty fun to him. And, you know, it all felt vaguely Trumpian. You know, it kind of felt like, you know, within this little bubble, he was fighting to preserve his own self-image as the hero of his story, while outside in the rest of the world, you know, he was either a villain or a punchline. But he was sort of clinging to this image of himself as a kind of, you know, as a kind of martyr, even as on some level I think he knew that wasn't really the case.
And the performative element was really punched in the piece by this one detail. Mike Cernovich had made the suggestion, I think it was him, that everyone link arms and sing We Shall Overcome. But you highlight that after those sort of three words, no one really knew the song.
Yeah, I mean, it was not a very well-rehearsed performance, let's put it that way. But, you know, again, that's just kind of this recycling of 60s imagery in this very weird funhouse mirror way. You know, I mean, the thing that they were overcoming was this kind of semi-imagined censorship that, you know, it's not exactly, you know, segregated bus lines, let's put it that way.
So ultimately, there was no press conference or drone footage, as Milo envisioned it, or really any of the theatrics. What happened during the event?
He told me that he went to Treasure Island and they were locking him out because they didn't like his views. And that's I didn't have a way to verify or not verify that. So it's possible that that's true. But basically, he wasn't able to go to have the press conference as he envisioned. And he just sat in his hotel room and streamed it live on Facebook. And, you know, a bunch of Facebook commenters kind of, you know, asked him a few questions, made fun of him a little bit. That was kind of it. Then they marched onto campus. Instead of marching through the streets, they were just, you know, snuck in by the police through a back door. And, you know, the crowd outside was kind of throttled by the police check-in, and by there was only one metal detector and one way to get into the square. So it was, you know, just a few dozen people on the square. Yeah, it was, you know, in the end, it kind of Free Speech Week lasted about 15 minutes, and then he left and actually went and got married in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a live stream video from the back of his SUV as it was leaving the campus, he said, "We don't care if the police are throttling access to make sure there's only 30 people there. None of that stuff is going to deter us because we don't crave acceptance and publicity the way liberals do. We just want to be left alone." Seems in stark contrast to the rest of your piece.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a disconnect there.
Yeah, it's just kind of a self-evidently hypocritical line. I was actually watching that live stream from a conference room in an administrative building with a bunch of deans and vice chancellors and people, and that line got a big laugh in the room. So I think I think people kind of get his shtick at this point. I mean, to be fair, the access was throttled, and there would have been more people there if the police checkpoint hadn't existed. So that part of it is true. It's just the notion that he's just trying to be left alone, I think, is pretty transparently silly.
So do you think people like Yiannopoulos or Richard Spencer are beginning to lose their enthusiasm for speaking on college campuses?
Definitely. I mean, Milo threatened to go back to Berkeley in the spring. He just didn't do it. He claimed to me until the last minute that he was going to, but he just didn't. He didn't, I guess, think it was enough of an upside for his brand. And Richard Spencer made this really interesting and I thought kind of shocking confession on YouTube where, you know, he had a few violent clashes outside of some of his college speaking gigs, one in particular at Michigan State, after which he said, "I don't want to do this anymore. Antifa is winning." Which I got to say kind of made me question my sort of previously held preconception that they were only, I mean, sort of watching the first event in February 2017, I kind of thought, well, it seems like Antifa's doing nothing but helping Milo here. After Spencer said that Antifa was winning and that they were scaring him off, it kind of made me question that. I mean, I personally am still not a fan of, you know, setting stuff on fire, but, you know, that does seem like a data point that the protests did have, at least in some part, their intended effect. I'm not really sure what to do with that personally.
So since Milo's encounters with the university, have other conservative speakers continued to make appearances at Berkeley?
Yeah, totally. There's been a lot. You know, Heather McDonald went there. Dennis Prager went there. There was a one that got a bunch of attention with Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens from Turning Point, where they engaged with some hecklers and they, you know, talked about building the wall. And, you know, they kind of hit some of their favorite talking points again and again and kind of, you know, handled the crowd, you know, to the delight of their supporters. And then a few days later, Kanye West came out as a supporter of Candace Owens or an admirer of hers or you know, what have you. So that kind of breathed new life into that little corner of the movement. But it's not as if, you know, Milo is the only person who is free to express these views. As he sort of slinks away, there are other people who are more than happy to take up the mantle.
So is your sense that any of these visits are generating any real policy or cultural changes on the Berkeley campus, or is it all show making something out of nothing?
I think it's both. I mean, it's clearly a show, but I mean, again, if words are meaningful, then, you know, then public speeches are meaningful. There's definitely a lot of self-branding and self-promotion that goes into anything like this. You know, a lot of times it's more about how many live streams you can get on Periscope than how many people you can pack into the room. A lot of times it's more about, you know, delivering that one moment of exquisite shade or, you know, reaction to a call out from the audience than it is about your sort of well-measured 45-minute lecture. But yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, I can't fully discount the notion that ideas are meaningful and speech is important.
Well, that point definitely comes across in the piece, and it's very well written. I'm grateful that you joined me here today to talk about it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with New Yorker contributing editor Andrew Morantz about his latest article, Fighting Words.